Malcolm drops down into this wash. It's about 20 feet. Drops down. I don't see him anymore. All of a sudden, I hear him like pawing up the other side, but he can't get up. And then he comes back and barks at me. And then I go and I'm like, okay, show me. And then we go in and the guy's there.
Welcome, everyone, to this 9th episode of Canine Top Tales, a podcast which showcases and honors the lives of canine warriors, crime fighters, protectors, and rescuers. These heroic dog stories are told by their law enforcement, military, and search and rescue handlers. I am your host, Sonia Nordstrom, a retired special agent of the FBI and a 25-year handler of search and rescue recovery canines, coming to you from the Heimdallar Ranch, the home of Sonia's dog training, in the beautiful mountains of Utah. I thank you all so much for listening and for all of your kind reviews and comments. Please keep them coming. My guest today has a very impressive history of service, starting out as a Navy SEAL, a veteran of Desert Shield and Desert Storm, then joining the Border Patrol in 1997, where he became one of the founding members of both the U.S. Border Patrol's Boar Star team and the Boar Star Canine Program. Boar Star stands for Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue. It provides specialized law enforcement search and rescue response from conventional to high-risk Border Patrol operations. So please enjoy this interview with my guest, Roy Lopez. Roy Lopez, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Canine Top Tales. How are you doing today?
Doing great.
Super. So I would love for you to start by just giving us some background on, I know that you've been with Boar Star and that you're recently retired, but maybe you can tell us about your beginnings and then how you got into Boar Star.
Definitely. So let's see. So you want me to go back to the Navy?
Yeah, why not?
So yeah, so when I got out of high school, wasn't sure what I was going to be doing after high school. Not a big fan of high school. The Navy recruiter contacted me and said, hey, you want to join the Navy? I'm like, no, not really. He said, well, you know, we can teach you about computers and we can teach you about this. And I'm like, nah, I'm not really interested. Then he said, well, what about the Navy SEALs? And I was like, what's that? I mean, this is...
Before anybody knew there was bling associated with that?
Yeah, before, before they did the movies and everything. So yeah, so I had no idea what he was talking about. So then he started describing it and yeah, jumping out of planes and diving and, shooting, blowing stuff up. I was like, yep, I'm 18. I'm a male. That sounds like something I could get into.
Every boy's dream, right?
Yeah. I was like, this is fantastic. So yeah. So little did I know, you know, what I was getting into. So went to boot camp, went to an A school because they used to put you through an A school first, which is like a school to learn a skill like, computers or radar or something like that. And so I went to OSA school, which is plotting and, you know, plotting the ship's location and distance and the planes and stuff like that. So they sent everybody there because there's such a high attrition rate at BUDS, at the Basic Underwater Demolition School. So I went there, then I went to BUDS and classed up. Didn't ring the bell, exactly. Ended up getting hurt after Hell Week or in Hell Week. I got a femur fracture, a green stick fracture. So that set me back. And then I reclassed up and, you know, graduated later on. Wow. In class 160. But went to the teams, went to the East Coast, SEAL Team 8, did a workup and deployed to, you know, the first Gulf War. And we were out there for 8 months and, you know, we did various operations and then I got out in 1992.
Then where did your path take you?
So I went to college for a few years and worked my way through college, got married in 1994 and then joined the Border Patrol in 1997, March of 97. Again, it sounded like a job that I would enjoy. You know, working outdoors. I had no idea about the canine program at that point. Just sounded great to be able to track people and, you know, be a part of law enforcement, be a part of enforcing the laws and protecting people, saving people, you know, doing all that stuff. So in October of 98, they started the BorStar program.
And tell us what BorStar stands for.
So that's the Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue Team.
Perfect.
And so there was there were a lot of people getting in distress that were crossing the border. They were crossing through the mountains and the deserts, and so they were getting stranded, they were getting injured, they were succumbing to the elements. And so the Border Patrol was looking for a way to save lives and be able to locate these people without infringing on the mission too much. So they decided to come up with a search and rescue team for the Border Patrol, which became BorStar. So I was in that first class that classed up in 1998, October 5th. And we did 6 weeks at that point. I think it's down to 4 weeks now for their academy. But we did 6 weeks. It was weighted litter carries, calisthenics, technical rope rescue, medical classes, search classes, ICS, swift water rescue.
That's a lot packed into 4 weeks.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I'm guessing that the selection of the people who were going to go in there had a lot to do with why they could do it that quickly.
Right. So they do like a pre-academy where they kind of weed people out, kind of see who's going to be able to make it through the academy. Because it's even
it's
with
rigorous.
even with the interviews and with the pre-screening, we still only graduate about 50% of the class at the end of the 4 weeks. So yeah, we put a lot of emphasis on teamwork and how this person is going to function as part of a team, as well as, you know, physical abilities and the ability to do the skills that we set up for them.
So is BorStar spread across Canadian border, across the whole U.S. southern border, or is it kind of focused in certain areas?
So it started in San Diego, and then it spread across the southern border. And there's even agents up on the Canadian border. Okay. I believe Washington State has a full team up there on the Canadian border. But its main focus is on the southern border, because that's where a lot of the rescues happen and the searches.
And you were involved in the initiation of the canine aspect of BorStar, and when did that start?
You know, our team was formed in 98, and we had a really high tempo between Border Patrol call-outs in San Diego, and then we were also doing a lot of call-outs with the sheriffs. And so, you know, we had a lot of calls, we had a lot of searches, we had a lot of rescues. And in doing all that, we noticed that, hey, you know what? Canines would probably be a great asset to our team, help us to locate these people, you know, quicker, save more lives. And so San Diego Sector BorStar contacted the Canine Center in El Paso and said, hey, we would like a search and rescue canine team to get started. Can you provide the training for us? And at first they said, no, we're not really interested. And that was because they were focused on narcotics detection. You know, this is the 80s and 90s. Coming through that, narcotics was the big thing for sure. And so the dogs were, you know, they were focused on finding narcotics and concealed people in trunks and cars and stuff like that. And but then they changed their mind and they said, okay, yeah, we'll put together, we'll do the research and we'll put together a course for you guys. So in January of 2001, the class started, the first class of the BorStar canines. And that was, they taught us obedience, search and rescue, area search, and trailing. Robert Noziska and myself were the students.
Yeah.
And Matt Devaney was the director who put the class together, and he was our instructor for the full 3 months.
So tell us about your first operational dog.
So the first, my first dog was Malcolm. He's a one-year-old black lab, field trial lab, just full of energy. You know, just no off switch whatsoever. Like I'm sure most one-year-old labs are. But San Diego insisted on labs. The Canine Center in El Paso was not very happy with that, but we insisted on labs. And to get labs of that caliber at that time, they said they're going to have to be, you know, super young, because once they get older, then, you know, they get into the field trials and then they don't sell them to law enforcement. So Malcolm, he was a fantastic trailing dog. I mean, he would trail at a run. So where it was hard to catch up to illegal border crossers when you're just using, you know, visual tracking skills.
Yeah.
It's pretty slow, you know. It's hard to catch up to groups that are running, almost impossible.
Yeah.
So then you put a dog on it like Malcolm, you put him on a group of five, a group of 10, and he's tracking or trailing at a run, pretty much as fast as I could go. You know, he was going.
At the end of a 30-foot lead.
Yep.
In the desert at night.
Yep. A lot of, yeah. That's a young man's game right there.
Yeah. No kidding. Oh my
God. A lot of falls in the dark, chasing Malcolm, but he just loved it. I mean, he was not happy at home when he could not be working. You know, he was just so happy to get to work, and he would trail and, you know, no matter what, like they use a lot of counter tracking techniques to stop us from following them visually. So they'll drag a blanket behind them. The groups will drag a blanket behind them. They'll wear booties. We call them booties, but they actually take blankets, Mexican blankets, and they tie them around their feet so you can't see any of the footprint.
Okay.
So it's really hard. It takes, you know, all they have to do is slow you down enough and so they can get away, then get to a vehicle and get out of the area. So, but with the dog, no difference whatsoever. Whatever, they can drag a blanket, they can drag a branch, they could put booties on, and the dog is just not.
Thank you very much for making a nice solid trail.
Yep. So it makes it easy. Yeah, it actually makes it easier for the dog. So that was, it was just a game changer, you know? I mean, there were dogs that were trailing. There were dogs that were tracking out in the Border Patrol, informally, narcotics dogs, and they were doing a good job. But once you added the academics to it and the actual certification, it just made it that much cleaner, that much more effective.
How many people in your X number of years at Borstar do you think you personally with your dog actually found? It's thousands, right?
Yeah. So it's, 1,964 I found with two dogs, and most of those were with Malcolm.
Wow.
So almost 2,000 apprehensions, apprehensions and rescues together. So over, 13-year career with those two dogs, it was almost 2,000. And I think that's pretty average for our dogs.
It's incredible. And then what, and how many on average together? Groups of 5, 10, groups of 50, groups of, you know.
Yeah, it goes back and forth. Some years there's big group, you know, in big groups come in north starting late January. And through the spring, there's, you know, it's not unusual to find a group of 20 people. So a group of 20, yeah, you're most of the time I'm moving so fast with the dog that I'm by myself. I mean, if I had a flanker with me, they're back there, you know, they couldn't keep up. So, you know, you catch a group of 20 by yourself, you're probably a couple hours from any backup. So, you know, you really have to rely on your officer presence, quick thinking and, setting.
Yeah. How does that work? I mean, honestly, how does that even work?
Yeah. You have to do your best to, gain control of the group while maintaining a safe position for yourself, which is, you can imagine in the dark, pretty challenging. I would usually, if the group was, you know, sometimes you get lucky and the group is asleep, You know, they're tired from their hike, and then, you know, you're a couple hours behind them, but you catch up to them, they're asleep. So you just quickly get in there, and, you know, we have these, we call them flexies, but they're,
Flex cuffs.
Flex cuffs. And so I just try to get in there and start flex cuffing as many people together as I can before waking everybody up. And then I'll just lead them out. I'll point the direction, or I'll stand by and have somebody come and meet me, and I'll tell them where I am and say, hey, help me walk this group out. And that's usually the best way to do it. But if you catch up to them and they're still moving, they see you, they see your flashlight. So I'll try to get to the back of the group and stop as many people as I can. And then try to get everybody else to stop, which, has a mixed results.
Yeah. Well, you can always track them again, I guess, from the leapfrog once you get back up. But I mean,
If I can get somebody to take, if I can get somebody to take those apprehensions off my hand, then I will definitely get on the rest of the group.
Was it pretty much every day that you'd get a, I mean, how did you even come on that initial track, right? Are you just kind of doing a perpendicular across the border and then hitting it? Or is the dog, or are you getting intel to go to a spot to get it?
Yeah, I'd go to the field. I'd go out to the east area of San Diego County, out in Campo or Boulevard, and I would just let them know that I was there with my dog. And yeah, they were really good at a lot of those stations. They would know me. They would know how effective the dog was, and they would just call me like, "Hey, yeah, we just cut this group." So cutting a group means they just saw the footprints across the border or across another road. Or a group activated a seismic sensor.
Okay.
So they would go to the sensor, then they find the footprints at the sensor. And so they call me up and say, "Hey, yeah, they give me their location. I go over there, and then I would just take a look at the sign, see how many people it was, how much sign there was. And then I would start my dog on it. And then hopefully they would stay with me. And if they couldn't, then I would be on the group by myself, and then I would just be calling out locations ahead, like, okay, we're heading towards, this intersection, or we're heading towards this tower.
So they can cut off.
Right. And then people would go and look for sign from their vehicle ahead of me. And then if they could get on them, if they could find their footprints across the road, then they would follow that track from there. And then I would get into their vehicle and then drive around and try to do the same thing for them. So it's called,
so it's just a leapfrog cutting for signs.
Exactly.
Sort of thing, right?
Just leapfrogging ahead. Wow. And, but yeah, that's pretty much a typical day would be just heading out there. And then if they had a group to get on, they were more than happy to let my dog get on it because of the speed and the accuracy of the dog.
Yeah. Predominantly day or evening for you?
Evenings.
Okay.
Evenings are really nice for the dog work just because of the cool temperatures.
And can you even describe, I think everybody hears a lot about the border, and believe it or not, some of my listeners don't live in the U.S. So maybe you can describe what the terrain is like and how inhospitable it really is.
So yeah, it's very, very mountainous. If we're working like in the Otay Mountain area, where they cross the border, and to where they get to the first road, it's straight uphill. And if you're in good shape, you could make it in 4 hours, 5 hours, but you have to be in really good shape to make it at that speed. That's to the first road, but then you have several more up and down canyons, before you actually get to a road where you could get picked up.
Is it so, kind of rocky or
rock? Yes, it's very rocky. See that? So like
lunar
that area.
Scape.
What's that?
Kind of a lunar scape is what I'm
in. Yeah, you know, if in it's the lunar scape is out there towards El Centro in the east part of San Diego, and it is pretty much just rock. So you are boulder hopping, and it's pretty darn near impossible to visually track it because it's all hard rock. But the dogs are just jumping up ahead, and they're going no problem on that lunar scape. And you know, lots of hiding spots. So it kind of turns from a track or a trail into a USAR mission.
Yeah, I mean, I bet.
They can get buried in those caves and rocks. I mean, they could be 30 feet down. It's not unusual.
Wow.
So I've had Malcolm. So Malcolm in the academy, we trained him to a recall refine with a sit indication. But in the field, he actually taught himself to do a bark indication.
Yep.
So we went with that. Didn't have much choice. He's like, this is what I like to do. So yeah, he would go on the rocks, the rubble, and he would just start barking. And I'm like, what are you talking about, buddy? Where? Show me. And he's just like putting his nose down and saying, right here. And then, you know, so I pull one guy out and I'm like, okay, it doesn't look like too many can fit in that, you know, that little hole right there. And then I end up pulling like 12 people out.
It's a clown car.
Yeah. So you just don't know how deep it goes in there. And
so do you have, I mean, with all of that, do you have sort of a couple of favorites that really stick out? Is that one of them, that sort of, you know, down in the cave kind of thing? Or do you have any others that you really feel like, wow, what a boy he was to do that one?
As far as like searching for border crossers that are in distress, we had like a 19 hour down track. They were backtracking. This was in Tucson. So if we're going to talk about terrain, you know, I'm talking about San Diego and it gets to be 100 degrees there, but every summer we would deploy to Tucson West Desert for 6 weeks at a time. And, you know, it's regularly over 110 degrees out there. And so the day shift of Border Star guys in Tucson, they contacted us. I was on the swing shift and they said, hey, we're working a rescue out here, or we're working a search. And a guy walked out to the road and he said he left somebody behind. And so they visually tracked it from the freeway and they had tracked it all day long. And so they had made it about 4 miles. And when we got to them and, they had lost it. They got to this dirt road and they were like, hey, yeah, we had it about 100 yards up there. It was coming this direction, but you know, we don't really have anything to go on from here. We've been looking for it for an hour. And so I'm like, well, I'm just going to give my dog a break and then we'll kind of make a plan and, you know, try to help out. So I took my dog out of the truck, not really thinking about it, just cut him off leash. And I'm, you know, finishing getting a briefing from these guys, what they've done, what they think. And then I notice my dog showing tracking behavior and he's going south. And I'm like, wait, that's tracking behavior. So I'm like, shoot. And he's already like, you know, 50 yards away. And I'm like, oh, shoot.
But why would he be backtracking?
Well, we did have to do backtracking also because a lot of our missions were.
So he chose the backtrack, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. And it was 100 and at least 115 degrees out there.
Boy, crazy.
Which I would say, nope, that's not going to happen. That's
exactly.
Impossible.
But, wow.
but like I said, you know, Malcolm makes no choices.
Yeah.
He chose to be a bark indication and now he's choosing to track. So I'm like,
go with it.
He's backtracking, so I'm going to go with that. And so I went, grabbed all my gear. I didn't have any of my gear. He didn't have a harness on or a leash or anything. So I went, grabbed all my gear, put him in a down. And then I put him on the track, said Zook. And we just followed it. And it was going in a straight line. So I'm like, he's definitely tracking something. And it wasn't any of our guys because nobody had been down there yet. So kept going. And then, I'm like, yeah, he's moving. And then I'm like, and then I run into an ATV guy. He's kind of helping me out. And I'm like, hey, did they give us any more information? And they're like, well, he said he left the guy under a tree. And I was like, okay, well, all the trees out here, there's no trees. It's a desert, except for in the washes, there's trees. So I'm like, well, the dog's kind of petering out here. I'm not sure about this track anymore. And I'm like, but I'm going to go up to this next wash that's like 200 yards away and I'm going to do a quick area search.
Yeah.
So I did that just like a hasty search along the top of it. And then Malcolm drops down into this wash It's about 20 feet, drops down. I don't see him anymore. All of a sudden I hear him like pawing up the other side, but he can't get up. And then he comes back and barks at me. And then I go and I'm like, okay, show me. And then we go in and the guy's there. He was already, dead. Oh, wow. But it seemed, you know, pretty fresh, but, I was just happy that we could find him when it seemed like it was kind of an impossible situation. And, but yeah, so that was kind of, as far as dogs' capabilities and just everything I saw from the dog, that was, one of my memorable tracks. Yeah.
Your host, Sonia, is the owner and trainer for Sonia's Dog Training and Heimdallr Canine Services. Sonia's Dog Training provides detection, nose work, scent work, and SAR workshops and seminars, as well as one-on-one training for the family pet. Remote sessions via Zoom or FaceTime and telephone consults are also available. Heimdallr Canine Services is a supplier of top-quality canines for personal, family, and executive protection. Heimdallr conducts hands-on selection from the finest breeders and kennels in Europe to locate top-tier dogs selected for their courage, stability, and health. We are happy to answer any questions you may have regarding adding a protection dog to your home and look forward to hearing from you.
He did great. He did a great job on that. And I was amazed. It always amazed me because I was like, here was no command, no nothing, but he's got that tracking drive and he just jumps on it on his own. And I was like, whoa, okay. I think you call that a clue.
Yep.
And go over there and work it. So
I just can't believe that they can acclimate to that heat. I can't even fathom working in that level of heat, because you can imagine if it's 115 air temperature, the ground temperature has to be burning their feet. I can't imagine that it's even doable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always chose to work super early mornings or evenings. But you know, sometimes you just can't help it when the call comes, you go. And, a lot of times I would be on a trail and I would just see him getting super fatigued and super hot. And then, so I would just cut him off leash and that way he could find a saguaro or a bush or something. And then he would go and sit in the shade. And then I would visually track at that point because it's just beyond his.
Yeah. I mean, he's got to live.
I don't know what the ground is, 130, 140
degrees. It's going to be crazy. And how much water did you have to carry for him? Or did he just kind of blow through it?
I would carry like 300 ounces.
Okay.
For him on my, you know, in a backpack.
Wow.
And, you know, and even then, you know, you sometimes need water drops from a helicopter or you need someone to come and meet you and give you water. But
he was a very good boy. I had a chance to meet him, which was fun. And we worked a couple of things together in San Diego. Cross
That's
paths,
right.
I should say, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. He's a great dog. It was just, it was
hard
so much
to let
fun.
Him go, huh?
Yeah.
So I assume he retired with your family. I know he did, right?
Yep.
Did he ever calm down or was he jealous when you went out with your next dog?
He did calm down. I mean, but you know what those senior dogs, I mean, they still think they're young.
Oh, I know. I'm dealing with it now. I got a 12 and a half year old that bounces.
He wanted to, but you know, then he got the arthritis and stuff. Yeah. And he was fine. When I brought my next dog home, he was fine with him.
Was that another lab?
Another lab, but this time it was more of a show lab.
Okay.
And this dog had no aggression issues or anything. This is just a sweet, sweet dog, the second one. And so Malcolm was kind of like looking at him and this guy's like, hey, what's up? And then they were fine. And then just, you know, one day after a couple months, just one day out of the blue, I think Malcolm realized like, hey, this guy's going to work with my dad and leaving me home.
Oh.
And then he just, you know, he just like went after him and
oh,
you know, got
him.
But the, you know, and so I felt so bad for him because I was like, oh gosh, he has to, you know, he did it for so long and now he can't do it. And
yeah.
So you know how hard that is.
It's awful. Did you get to select the next dog? What was the name of the next dog?
The next dog was Alex.
Alex. And did you get to select him, or was he, did you also go back to El Paso to get him?
Yeah, I went to El Paso and they were like, hey, and I still had Malcolm, but you know, I wanted to make sure I got a good dog. I was there doing instructor recertification. So that's like a 2-week course we have to do every 3 years. So one of the instructors there said, hey, you know, we've had this dog in the kennel for like 4 or 5 months. It's a lab. I'm like, ooh, I'd love a lab. They're like, yeah, we'll take a look at him, see what you think. So I took Alex out of the kennel. He looked like a little black bear cub because he was all chubby because he'd been in the kennel for 4 months. He was all chubby. His hair was all overgrown. So he literally looked like a bear cub. So I'm like, well, I don't know. We'll see. And so I took him out to the field to do a little testing with him. So I had him in the truck and I laid a track, just like a heavy scuff track, maybe 100 yards out. Then I circled around and came down a Jeep trail, walked back to the truck. I let him out of the truck to start him on that track. He puts his nose down on the Jeep trail and starts backtracking down the Jeep trail. Down where I came. And I'm like, okay.
That'll work.
That's a pretty good sign.
Had they been working with him?
I don't think they'd done very much with him.
Okay, well, enough apparently that he knew that he was supposed to do that.
Yeah, they hadn't. I mean, maybe they took him out a couple of times, but it was nothing very much. And I was like, whoa, that looks pretty good without any command. And so then I put him on the actual track I laid, and oh, he smoked it. And I was like, okay, well, let me lay another one just to make sure. And then I laid another one, and boom, he just nailed it. He was just true tracking. He had just off the charts tracking drive that I could see, and he was just so into it. And I was like, I told him I wanted that dog, and then so I got to take him home.
Well, so why do you think that Borstar doesn't lean toward the bloodhounds? Is it because of the versatility of the lab, or the size, or other reasons?
Well, they get their dogs from Europe, so for the most part. So the vendors come with the dogs, and so they, whatever they have is what we have to choose from. So it's usually Belgian Malinois and German Shepherds, and maybe some German Shorthairs in there, and a lot of breeds like that.
So basically, the dogs that go to Borstar aren't necessarily selected specifically for Borstar. They're just selected as dogs for Border Patrol that could do anything, and then they end up going to Borstar.
Right. So so we test the dogs. So the dogs come with the vendors, and we test them. So they have to, we test, you know, for their hunt, their air scent, their retrieve, and their prey with various tests. And then they'll choose to buy them. And then Borstar will go and test them some more, test their sociability, you know, see their reactivity if they have any, and then test them for tracking. And then if they have that, you know, then they'll come on over to the Borstar program.
Okay. And are you're one of the trainers then? Didn't you help develop the program, the training program?
Yes, So we started the regular Borstar canine program with the SAR area search and the trailing in 2001. And then, you know, in doing missions, I started to notice like, hey, we could really use some human remains detection dogs because we're having a lot of deaths in the field that we need help locating, and a dog would really help out with that. Through the North American Police Work Dog Association, I knew Kathy Barrett, and I talked to her about it, and she was like, yeah, we're having our 6-week, cadaver dog course, New England State cadaver dog course, in October. If you can get over here, we'll train you for free. And so I worked it out with my management and went over there and went through their course, with Malcolm. And then I came back and started working on a course for the Border Patrol. So I took the knowledge I gained in New England, several SAR workshops, and the existing Border Patrol detection program, and put it together and created the Border Patrol's Human Remains Detection Program, which kicked off in 2007.
It sounds excellent. It sounds absolutely excellent.
It was a lot. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun putting it together. It was a lot of work. But just to see, you know, where it's gone from that small class of two handlers, and now there are several dozen Borstar canines that are cross-trained with human remains detection across the country and in other countries as well.
And I see you do quite a bit of water work as well.
Yes. So when I developed the program, I wanted it to be all inclusive, like not just land cadaver or not just water or not just, you know, so I wanted it to be include everything because you never know what you're going to get called to. So we do the imprinting, and then we advance it, and we cover everything with vehicles, open area search, shoreline search, buildings, boat search, and all that is part of our certification as well.
So if you were to say, who's probably been the most influential person in your canine training?
I don't know. It's not really a canine handler. I would have to say that one of my early supervisors in the Border Patrol, Michael Doolittle, I'd have to say he was the most influential during my career. He was just a really good guy, a really good supervisor, a really good friend. And he was always supportive of whatever we had to do. I mean, we were starting, all this stuff started from scratch. The Borstar program started from scratch. The Borstar canine program started from scratch. The Borstar human remains detection program, you know, and all along the way, he was my supervisor at Campo Station. Then he was my supervisor at Borstar. And all along the way, he was just like, hey, what do you need?
That's what a good supervisor should do. Run interference, get rid of the obstacles, and facilitate progress.
Exactly.
I think many more of them need to know that.
Amen.
Right.
But yeah, that's how he was. And even I started doing later on in my career, I started doing two-week trailing classes for the narcotics guys. And it started at his station. He was the patrol agent in charge of Boulevard Station at the time. And he was just like, well, yeah, we're not going to let anything stand in our way. I want these dogs to work our area because they're super effective. And let me know what you need. You need the time? Here you go. And so it was just that kind of mindset, that kind of encouragement that he gave that I'd say he's probably the most influential.
Super. So with regard to the breeds, you obviously had your labs. And I know that you work a whole bunch of Malinois and Shepherds. Do you find people have personal preferences, but do you find that it's easier with certain breeds than others for the tracking in particular?
I have to mention Dutch Shepherds as well, or else
I'll get hate mail. Because I'm the Dutch Shepherd girl. I'm on my fourth.
I'm sorry. That was a huge mistake for me not to mention Dutch Shepherds in my expertise. Breed-wise, I like the German Shepherds, or labs, obviously, but take labs off the table, I'd have to say German Shepherds are really, we have a lot of success with the German Shepherds.
They're super methodical.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I like about them.
Kind of a more settled brain, perhaps.
Yes. I mean, I'm not, they're fantastic Dutch Shepherds and Mals, obviously. But I've had a lot of luck with German Shepherds. It's very methodical, and when you want to go slow, when you want to be methodical, when accuracy is super important, German Shepherds are really good.
Any sort of myths going into this that you feel need to be dispelled?
I think a myth that I discovered kind of midway through my career is that just because someone tells you that an area's been covered or thoroughly searched, it's not necessarily the case.
Put a dog on it.
Yeah. I've kind of been burned a few times and learned the hard way, like to just I just say, okay, that's nice. And I'm still going to go to the PLS.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of one of the lessons that I think everybody should take away is, you know, just because people have been through there, just because dogs have been through an area, maybe you still need to start there and see where you go.
If they are sort of cross-training the narcotics dogs, it isn't still probably that dog's focus in the way that the Borstar dogs are truly focused on the task of trailing.
True.
So it may not be done to the same level of proficiency, even though probably very well done with very good dogs. It still isn't maybe the focus, right? So probably not a bad idea to double that up. What advice would you have for trailing dog handlers and specifically if they really want to up their game and be more proficient?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. I'm focusing on tracking now going into the new year. I've kind of had human remains detection on my mind in 2020, and then I'm trying to put more of a focus on that through the winter. But I'd say focusing on tracking, since tracking is the actual drive that the dogs have, and that's from the German police service dog school. Tracking is the drive that they use. They blend it with air scent when we look at what a dog is doing, and we call it trailing. Like Malcolm, he was a great trailer because he moved fast, and it didn't matter if the footprints were there or not. He was moving
almost like a vapor wake in a weird way. A human's right. A vapor wake, right?
Right, exactly. So he's moving fast. But I would say to focus on discipline. Like our program is really focused on a controlled start and getting a really good start, and because the dog is forming his scent picture, that whole, you know, not only at the start, but, you know, for the good first 50 feet of the track. If you focus on tracking, you can trail. The dog will naturally trail. The dog trails when he can't track. So if you go to pavement, if it's too hot, if it's too windy, the dog is going to trail. And that's him using more of his air scent drive. But if you train trailing, that's a much looser way of training the dog. And so your accuracy is going to suffer as a result.
Well, it kind of probably parallels the, if you train for 100% and you lose 40%, you still have 60. If you train for 60% and you lose 40%, you're almost down to nothing.
Exactly. That's a great illustration right there.
Yeah, and when you say tracking, I mean, we talk about ground disturbance, the human scent. Which do you think the tracking really, I mean, on a rock, is the ground disturbance really going to throw a lot of odor, or is it really the human scent, but it's just a deep nose human scent?
Yeah, it's really the human scent. But what I'm training when I start the dogs, and I think everybody should do this, but you're really learning when you start the true tracking and you're using the ground disturbance, you're learning what this dog looks like when he's on track. So that is so important for you to learn that. It's also important to teach your dog what to do when he loses it. So you want to teach the dog to circle back. So that's two of the things I really focus on when I start, is teaching this dog to circle back. Because most dogs want to go ahead. Like they'll lose the track and then they'll be like, oh, well, I'll look
just
up here.
Run and through. Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah,
I've gotten successful up here. And, you know, and if they get successful a few times, then they've trained themselves to just kind of wander ahead.
Yes. Yes.
So yeah. So if you have a good, solid tracking dog, you've got good leash communications, you've got good voice tones, communication with the dog, then you can just take that dog. Then it's the dog's ability to be able to follow it down a city street, or, you know, through a park or wherever. All your mechanics are going to be exactly the same.
Well, I when I very first started with my team in Pennsylvania, they wanted a TDX on every dog, and I had my little collie mix. And I'm sure you've never had the pleasure of training in light frost.
Right.
And so when you talk about reading the dog, my little girl, her little tail would swing in a very rhythmic way. And then I'd see a bunny track that would go across and her tail would fly up. And then I'm like, nope, track. And she's like, okay. And then she'd swing very, and then a deer track. And then her, so it was so funny to be able to see the animal tracks that crossed and her little body got all excited. I'm like, no, you got it. She was, you know, we didn't.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. You can say, oh, so this is what they're getting distracted on.
Yeah. So while we're on the topic of how to train properly, why don't you tell us about your retirement venture? I know you've been doing it for quite a while, going out and teaching seminars, but now you're very formalized. So can you tell us about your business?
Yes, it's Core Canine Concepts, corecanineconcepts.com. And this year, when I was just kicking it off, you know, I was writing classes and putting classes together in PowerPoints. And it was good that I kind of started like that because all the COVID hit. And so I went, I was just about ready to go right to webinars. And so I did several webinars this year and had a lot of really good feedback from it. They were 2 hours long, which is a little long, but each night was four classes. And it just took you through all the classes, or most of the classes we get in the Border Patrol, starting with drives and character traits and modular training and selection testing and conflict training and handler skills and searching vehicles, searching buildings. And it was good. I had fun doing it. And so now I have those recorded. And so what I'm trying to move forward with is setting up training in your area, in different areas that people, you know, so their team doesn't have to come out to California to see me, but I can go out to them. And then before I get there, I can send them all the classes so that they can watch them at home. And so I don't have to go there and teach them. They can get all that academics ahead of time. And then, so when I go for the weekend training or whatever they have me do for a few human remains, we can just hit the ground running.
Yeah, that's super smart because you put a leash in someone's hand and they're not paying attention to anything but their dog.
Yeah.
And so it's funny because I've been doing that as well. I've been sending out information ahead of time and hoping that people will sort of digest it and then have maybe different questions than they may have had if they hadn't had the information ahead of time.
Right.
Or maybe had a chance to think about like, wow, I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah. I find it helps a lot. And I've done it the other way. I've done it where I show up and then I try to teach or try to troubleshoot. And it's just, I'm like, oh, well, if you had these classes, you would know what I'm talking about. But so now I'm like, I've got the classes. I send them out. When I get there, the first day we do like 6 hours and we don't even take the dogs out. We just focus on handler skills because we don't want to be messing up the dogs. We focus on voice tones. We focus on leash handling. We focus on, pre-search rituals and a lot of different stuff. And then when we're ready or more ready, then we take the dogs in. And then, so I like that system seems to work really good for me.
Super. And actually I visited your website because I wanted to look and see what was going on. And the question I had was, are some of those, you've listed all of the different, I guess, webinars, courses, whatever, are they, if they are recorded, are they available for purchase individually?
Not right now, but they will be.
Good. Because I'd like to dip into some of them. I'm like, ooh, I'd like to see that one and that one. So that would be a really neat direction to go.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm moving. I'm glad you brought that up. Making those available and maybe even doing like a subscription service. And I'm really going to focus on making videos here and putting them out, sending a lot of them out just for free, just for training for people and kind of see what I'm all about, what my philosophy is about, and kind of a try before you buy type of thing. So
perfect.
Yep. Those will be upcoming.
So my final questions are always favorite piece of canine gear, favorite piece of handler gear.
Let's see. Favorite piece of canine gear. That would be a 20-foot leather lead with the handle cut off, 1/2 inch in thickness. And that just, it's really handy for tracking, obviously. It's a good length. You can drop it, and if you don't have a handle on it, it's less likely to get wrapped up on stuff. It works really good in your hand, being only half inch thick. And yeah, even if I forgot a harness, I could still clip into the dog's collar and go under the arm and do a track. Yeah. And then for cadaver, for like, I'll use a 20-foot lead for buried searching, and especially when I start that and getting the dog to used to a gritting pattern and stuff, it's indispensable. And I'll also use it for shoreline. So I'd have to say that's probably the most important piece of canine gear. And then as far as handler gear, in the last couple of years, we started using an ATAC, which is an app that was designed or modified for the Border Patrol. And it's basically a mapping app that shows you where you are, and it has a moving map, and it shows where all your other team members are. And you don't have to, like, I'm sure your listeners can relate to having to stop on a track or having to stop during a search and update your location. And, you know, it kind of takes away from your searching and the fluidity of it and everything. Well, this ATAC app that we started using automatically updates your location and everybody's location. And so you can know where everybody is.
That's the letter A with T-A-C?
T-A-K. A-T-A-K. And okay. It stands for Android Tactical Assault Kit.
Oh, nice.
And so, you know, somebody can be even back in the office or back at the command, and they can just see where everybody is, and they can move assets in front of you or bring them up to you, or, you know, kind of let you know what's been searched, what hasn't been searched, without even, you know, having to call in or so it saves radio traffic. It's better for officer safety. So yeah, that I'd have to say that was probably the best piece of handler gear.
Super. And any closing words of wisdom that you would like to share? Last word.
Yes. So I thought about this, and this is something I've been thinking about for the last few years, especially with after I did a pretty big track for a missing 3-week-old baby. The baby got kidnapped by a relative. So I was at home, I was off duty, and I got a call. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening. I think it was a Friday. And I got a call from my supervisor who said, hey, the sheriffs are calling us. They've got a 3-week-old baby that was kidnapped by a relative. The boyfriend drove the kidnapper and the 3-week-old out to an open area by a ravine, and they've kind of narrowed down the area, but you know, they'd like your dog to come and help out. So I was like, okay, yeah, happy to help, love to do it. You know, this is kind of what I live for. So I drove over there to the CP, checked in. And they're talking to me, and they're like, hey, okay, we want you to go over to this area and, you know, and search with your dog. And I was like, okay, I didn't leave home to come and, you know, just search some random far off area. I was like, where did you find the car seat and the purse? And they were like, well, that's over here. And I was like, okay, well, that's where I'm going to start. And I wasn't, you know, I'm not being cocky or anything. It was just,
this is, you know, the protocol to find somebody.
Right. I've been
with a trailing dog. It's that simple.
Yeah. You go to the, you know, yeah. You go to the PLS.
And how many hours after was this?
This was, I think this was about 5 hours after.
Okay. What time of day?
It's about 7 o'clock now.
In the evening. And, okay, good.
Yeah. So they're like, okay, so someone leads us over there. We drive to the area. I'm getting my stuff ready because I'm trying to focus mentally. And this is kind of what, you know, brought this up, like less, you know, lessons learned and, you know, finishing remarks. So I'm getting my stuff ready. I'm making sure I'm doing everything the way I train, you know, because it's so easy when you're caught up and you're looking for a child to
get emotional.
Yeah, to get emotional and to try and skip steps. You know what I mean? And those steps that you skip are could be the difference. So I'm really focused on making sure I got my water, making sure I got my GPS turned on, and I'm just kind of taking my time. And I'm also kind of letting the sun go down so that it becomes more still, because I was kind of right at that twilight time.
Yep.
And so I'm like, yeah, that'll probably be better for a track. So I get out of the car and I've got a flanker with me, and my flanker goes and he talks to the deputy, because they've got a perimeter around the whole area, and he talks to a deputy that's there near the start. And then he comes over, and then my flanker comes back to me, and he's like, "Hey Roy, they think she's out of the area." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, based on what?" And he's like, "Oh, I don't know." I'm like, "Based on they didn't find her. That's what it's based on." And he's like, "Oh, well, okay." And so, you know, they kind of upset me, because that's the kind of psychological mind games that start going on in your head. Like, okay, well, she's out of the area, so
we'll just go through the motions.
And yeah, we'll just go through the motions. And even if you don't think that you're doing that, you are, if it enters your mind. So I'm like, yeah, well, they don't know, just because they didn't find him. So what they had already told me was that they've had 100 ground pounders through the area. They had 100 searchers through the area, and they had already had 3 dogs through the area. And so, I mean, I can't fault the deputy. He's like thinking, yeah, she's out of the area. That's why all these people hadn't found her. But I had to push that out of my mind. And that was, you know, that's just something that I learned through the years, was, you know, you have to push all that doubt out of your mind and just be like, I'm just going to do this just like training. So we walk over to there's a car seat and then a purse and I think a diaper bag or something. So I just take my time. I get my 4x4s. I stick some in the purse, some in the car seat. So I'm making scent articles with these 4x4 gauze. So I can take them with me and I can start. So I take my time, another 10 minutes, probably 15 minutes. And you know, my flanker's getting anxious, like, "Hey Roy, should we start?" I'm like, let's just cool down. Let's just calm down. You know, let's just get everything in control. Let's just, you know, let's do it like we train. And so I get the scent articles, the gauze, I put them on the ground. I cast the dog on them. After doing my ritual, the dog sniffs the gauze, and then he goes over to the car seat and he just takes a huge whiff, and he's just like I've never seen him before. He was just like taking in that scent, that baby scent. And so I'm like, okay, you know, at this point we're kind of already starting the track, and I didn't even present that, but he did it on his own. And so we start tracking, and we track for I got good tracking behavior for probably 200 yards. And we end up kind of going in a half circle. And I'm like, okay, that's weird, you know, because, you know, we're kind of going back to where we started. Going all on dog behavior. I'm focused on that dog's tracking behavior and try not to think about anything else. So he comes back, give him a break. And I'm like trying to think. I'm like, gosh, you know, what's going on here, you know? And so I'm like, okay, well, give him a break. And then I'm going to restart him on a track. So I restart the dog. And then this time we kind of go up this exact same way we had gone the first time, but this time we break right instead of left, and we end up at a bunch of standing bamboo. It's like probably 60 feet around, and it's standing bamboo, and there's lots of hiding places in there. And so I'm like, well, the dog's kind of lost it here. I'm like, I'm just going to cast the dog inside this bamboo in these hiding spots and see if he comes up with anything. So I keep the dog off leash, and I give him a Versgift, and he goes. And instead of going into the bamboo where I'm casting him, he breaks hard right and goes out of sight. And I'm like, that's weird. And he's gone for about a minute, and he comes running back, pops a sit. And I'm like,
he's got dog. A mind. Yeah. Show me.
I should have said that, but I was like, dog, you better not be lying to me. I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm like, wow, this is just like training. This is, you know, all these things are going through my head, but I'm like, show me. So I go running after the dog and he probably runs 60 feet and he goes, takes me right in. And I see a woman holding the baby and I'm like going in and I'm like, well, wait a second. We don't know how hostile this is or anything, you know, because we didn't know what she was going to do, kill the baby or what. And so, oh, quickly I draw down and we, you know, step back, draw down and have her walk out a little bit out of the brush and then hand in my partner the baby. And then, you know, we handcuffed her and checked the baby. My partner was a paramedic, so he's checking the baby over, making sure the baby's good. And, you know, we took her, turned her over to the deputy and yeah, it was fantastic. Just a fantastic
Unbelievable.
And, you know, for all the SAR people out there, you know, I mean, for me personally, I was like, I want that child find, you know, that was like, that's the most valuable thing to me in my mind, being a searcher, being a canine handler. I wanted to, you know, have something like that. And it just kind of worked out perfectly. And you know how hard it is to have all the perfect, environment, perfect situation.
It wasn't a gimme by any means. And you know, it brings me back. My very first trainer 25 years ago, he said, your dog finds one person. You have validated every hour of training, every bit of, you know, work that you put into it. Finding a live child, you can multiply that by 1,000. Yeah. So it's congratulations. That's a beautiful. And that was pretty recently?
2013.
Do that. So with your newer dog.
Mm-hmm.
Good boy.
Yeah.
Good boy.
He did a great job and man, just so rewarding, you know, just to know we found that child.
And so the wisdom from that is?
The wisdom from that is the psychology, you know, the mental games that you just have to, you have
practice
to force.
Like you play.
Yep. Practice like you play, but force yourself. Yep. Force your mind to not entertain all the things that you're hearing around you that, oh, she's out of the area. Oh, I'm just wasting my time. Oh, you know, 100 people have been through here. Like 100 searchers had been through. I mean, logically it seemed like a waste of time, but, you know, it's just, you have to get your mind under control and focus and just, you know, lean back on your training.
That's fantastic advice.
Thanks.
I can reflect back on searches where I should have followed it. So I really absolutely relate to what you're saying. It's fantastic.
It's a constant battle.
Yeah. Well, Roy, I will put your business contact information and some of your background bio on the show notes. And I very much appreciate your time this morning. It's been really fun to chat and catch up. And I'm sure our paths will be crossing since we're both retired and we'll be out playing with dogs. And we're going to see each other in a couple of weeks in California, which will be fun.
Yes. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime. Anything I can do to help.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Canine Top Tales. I certainly hope you all enjoyed it. And I do hope that you'll take the time to leave us a kind review and let us know how we're doing. So take care, everyone, and come back and listen to us again.